Boot Stoner pulled his horse to a stop and paused to look at the railroad tracks before him. They'd not been there the last time he had ridden through this part of the territory with Billy Sorefoot and Henry Dodge. He took a few moments to speculate on the tracks, wondering where they went. Finally, he turned to Lily, sitting patiently on her pony behind him.
You know about this railroad?
It's the MKT.
MKT?
Missouri, Kansas, and Texas Railroad.
Well, I'll be. So, if we go that way, we'd end up in Texas. If we go that way, we'd end up in Missouri.
He kicked his horse into motion, crossing over the tracks and continuing in a westerly direction. Lily followed without a word from him, the pack mules on a line behind her. Jackrabbit Creek had not changed since Boot had seen it over 12 years ago. It was still a cluster of four shacks. Two on either side of the creek, at a point where it took a sharp turn back on itself, reminding one of a jackrabbit's hind leg. Boot continued toward the first of the four shacks, walking his horse slowly up to a rickety porch that had separated from the front of the house at one end. The barrel of a rifle was just barely showing in the dark interior of the doorway.
That you, Billy?
Who wants to know?
You sure as hell got cranky since I saw you last.
A stocky man with a large head stepped out onto the porch, still holding the rifle before him. Dark, brooding eyes searched the face of his visitor from under heavy, woolly eyebrows.
Boot? Is that you?
Ain't nobody else.
Well, I'll be go to hell.
Billy propped the rifle inside the door and walked out to shake Boot's hand.
I swear, if you ain't a sight for sore eyes, hell, I figured you'd rot inside that damn prison. Step down and come on in. I reckon I might be able to find a little something to cut the dust.
Billy stepped back as if to take a broader look, staring first at Lily, then at the two pack mules loaded with supplies taken from Jacob Mashburn's ranch.
Yes, sir, you are a welcome sight, all right. I see you got yourself a little gal, too. Looks like you ain't wasted no time. When did you get out?
A couple of weeks ago. This place looks like it's seen some hard times.
Other faces appeared in the doorways of the other three shacks, but no one came outside.
Get down, girl.
Billy's eyes never left the young girl as she obeyed Boot's order.
Damn, she's a pretty little thing.
Creek, and she belongs to me.
Creek don't make no difference to me. She's a pretty little thing. Now, don't go getting your back up. I'm just looking, that's all.
Billy stepped up on the porch and waited.
Well, come on in the house. It sure as hell calls for a drink.
Boot tied the horses to the porch post, leaving the mules to stand on the lead rope tied to Lily's saddle. While the horses were being tied, Billy walked over to the edge of the porch.
Henry! It's Boot Stoner!
Almost immediately, a thin, gaunt man with a full beard stepped out of the shack next door, holding a shotgun.
Well, damn me. Boot Stoner. Howdy, Boot. Last time I seen you, you was hightailing it across the ridge after we split up with them cattle.
That's a fact.
Oh, it's a damn shame you's the only one they could pin that job on. But them's the breaks.
Yeah, them's the breaks, all right. 12 years with the breaks.
Yeah, it's a damn shame. But there wasn't nothing nobody could do about it. And you're out now and don't look no worse for wear, so come on in and let's have a drink. Yes, sir, old Boot's back and got him a woman.
I see he has.
Inside the house, Lily was subjected to additional scrutiny, although this time it was devoid of admiration. Next to a small stove in the kitchen, Rena Big Dog stood, stoically watching her husband's guests. A Cherokee, Rena did not like Creeks, and she had heard through the open door when Boot remarked that Lily was a Creek. Being fat and past 30, Rena was also unfriendly toward slim young women, white or Indian, especially when they caused a certain gleam in her husband's eye.
Fetch me a bottle.
Her sullen expression unchanging, Rena did as she was told. She reached into a cupboard and produced a half-empty bottle. Placing it on the table, she then got three cups from the same cupboard.
Set yourselves down, gents. We'll drink to having old Boot back.
The half bottle of whiskey was soon emptied while they sat around the table. The talk was mostly about the state of things in the territory since Boot had been away.
Yeah, things been pretty hard around here lately. We ain't been doing as many jobs as we used to. Getting old, I reckon. We hit a few farmers in Kansas, and two banks that kept us in high cotton for a while, but not much lately. Mostly, we just been holed up back here in the nations.
When was the last time you went out on a job?
Well, hell, I don't know. I reckon 3, maybe 4 weeks ago. When did we steal them cows over in Oswego, Henry?
I expect it was a month ago.
Anybody else ride with you?
Virgil and Lem. They live in them two houses across the creek. Virgil Potts and his half-wit cousin Lem Stokes. They joined up with me and Henry not long after you left. Set up in them two old shacks across the creek.
While the three men sat around the table talking, Lily sat on a stool in the corner of the shack, trying to attract as little attention to herself as possible. As cruel as Boot was, she feared more for her safety in the presence of these other two vile-looking fugitives.
Woman, make us something to eat.
Lily started to get up to help. However, the scowl she received from the Cherokee woman was enough to make her withdraw to her stool again.
Don't let her scare you, honey. She don't like seeing those sweet young things traipsing around her kitchen.
Boot cocked an eyebrow at that.
I swear, Boot, you get your back up every time I look at that gal. I don't mean no harm. Hell, me and Henry's got a little job planned you might want to come along on.
What kind of job?
We've been keeping an eye on a little settlement over in Kansas, Oswego. Last time we was over that way, looking for livestock, we couldn't help noticing how much that little town had grown. And there's a fella built a general store on the south end that sure looks mighty prosperous. Right, Henry?
That's right.
Me and Henry is of a mind to pay that little store a visit. Hell, that man's bound to be packing money away. There ain't no other place around for folks to buy the goods.
They got a bank over there?
Nah, town ain't big enough to have a bank yet. That's why we're pretty sure the owner of that store must have all the money in town.
Them other two fellows you mentioned, are they figured in on this deal?
Well, sure. Lem and Virgil's part of the gang.
Not interested. I'll be better off by myself.
Hell, you can at least think it over for a minute or two before you say no. Now, we need some more whiskey. We got a lot of talking to do. Henry, why don't you go see if Virgil's got some?
When Henry started to get up, Billy stopped him with a wink of his eye.
Never mind. Hell, I'll go myself.
Using a felled tree as a footbridge, Billy Sorefoot crossed over the creek and, without knocking, walked into one of the cabins. Virgil Potts' bare backside was shining as he labored between the ample thighs of an Indian woman.
Get up from there, Virgil. We got bigger fish to fry.
Billy went straight to the cupboard while Virgil extricated himself from the massive embrace of his woman.
Well, there ain't many fish bigger than Sally Redbeads. It's about finished anyway.
Where's your liquor?
Billy found it on the top shelf. He grabbed the bottle.
You know who's sitting over at my table right now?
Who?
Boot Stoner.
Who?
Boot Stoner. Now, I told you about Boot. Used to ride with us till the law caught him. He just got out of prison over in Arkansas.
Oh, what the hell do I care? What's he want anyway? You ain't asking him to throw in with us, are you? We ain't hardly got enough to share as it is.
See, that's the thing. Boot don't want to join up with us. But he come riding up with two pack mules loaded down and a young gal. I'm thinking we could use all that stuff. Including the gal.
Well, what if he don't want to share his stuff with us?
Share it? Hell, I ain't talking about sharing nothing. Boot Stoner ain't likely to share nothing anyway. We're gonna have to kill him.
Oh, well, that makes sense, then.
We'll most likely be doing the law's work for him anyway. From a trail he's left between here and Arkansas, I'd be surprised if there ain't a lawman on his tail already and leading right to us. Get Lim and come over to my place.
Back inside Billy's cabin, Henry Dodge had been trying to convince Boot to reconsider his decision to move on. He had caught the significance of Billy's wink when he left to get more whiskey, and his mind was running in the same groove as Billy's. Two pack mules of goods was a hell of a lot for a man just out of the hoosegow. Like Billy, Henry was itching to see what was in those packs. Boot was adamant in his decision, however, and there was no amount of talking on Henry's part that could make him change his mind. He was preparing to take his leave when Billy returned with the whiskey.
Here we go! Let's have a drink to the good old days. Before Judge Parker came to Fort Smith. Virgil and Lem will be here in a minute or two. They're good boys. Lem Stokes is a little tits in the head, but he's handy to have around when you need an extra gun. He don't shit without Virgil telling him to. Virgil's right as rain, though.
Seeing no need in turning down one more drink, Boot sat down again. One drink led to another, with most of the talking done by Billy Sorefoot, and mostly about the good old days when Boot was just a wild kid, and the three of them were the principal hellraisers in the Cherokee Nation.
Howdy, boys. Pull up a seat.
The reunion was joined by Virgil Potts and Lem Stokes after the second round. They both nodded to Boot and favored him with wide smiles. Boot paid little attention to the pair, responding with a brief nod before returning his attention to the bottle. On her stool in the corner, Lily became more and more worried, especially with the arrival of the last two. Both men leered at her as they sat on a rough bench at the table. Of the same cut as Billy and Henry, Potts had a particularly lecherous gleam in his eye. His friend, the man identified as Lem Stokes, openly gaped at her with the primitive expression of a hound dog. Averting her eyes to avoid contact, she returned her gaze to Boot. He seemed unaware of the potential danger building as the level in the bottle went down. As miserable as her life had become with Boot Stoner, she shivered when she considered her fate if she were to somehow fall into the hands of the other four. It was bound to come to a head. When Billy figured the group had mellowed sufficiently from the alcohol, he broached the subject that Lily feared might come.
Yeah, it's been a mighty long time since I had a roll in the hay with a young gal like her. Since we're partners, I know I'd be proud to share with you if things were the other way around.
Oh, that's what I was thinking. It's got to where riding Sally Red Beans ain't much better than plowing a field.
I ain't your partner, and I damn sure ain't planning on sharing my woman with you.
Well, now, see, Boot, me and the boys are real disappointed in your attitude. We thought we was partners. Truth is, we figured we ought to have a share in whatever you're carrying in them packs out there, too.
Virgil Potts, unable to wait a moment longer, made the fatal mistake of reaching for his pistol. Unnoticed by anyone, Boot had taken the precaution of slipping his revolver from the holster and laying it in his lap when Virgil and Lem first came in the house. Boot caught Lem Stokes with the next shot. Henry Dodge managed to get his gun out. Boot shoved the table over on him. That left Billy Sorefoot as the only survivor, and Boot brought his pistol to bear on him, while Billy, now seated on the floor, had his gun only halfway out of the holster. Seeing that he had no chance, Billy let his pistol ease back into the holster.
Oh, don't shoot! Don't shoot! You was always quicker than anybody I'd ever seen. Now, I don't blame you for killing them two. But I never told you turn on me and Henry. Hell, we go way back. We can start over, you and me. Why, hell, we could ride up in Kansas and Missouri, partners, like we used to. No hard feelings. Think about it.
I'll tell you what. Why don't you think about it on your way to hell?
With her back pressed as tightly against the corner as she could manage, Lily sat next to her overturned stool, her hands clamped tightly over her ears, her eyes wide open in terrified shock. Ignoring her, Boot turned his gun to seek out Rena Big Dog in case she had notions of avenging her husband, but Rena had fled with the first shot fired. Boot walked outside, where he spotted Rena and Sally Redbeads running for their lives. With the two Indian women already out of pistol range, he holstered it and pulled his rifle up. He paused then, hesitant to waste ammunition. The decision was made for him, however, when the two fleeing women disappeared over the edge of the riverbank. He shrugged and lowered the rifle. Turning on his heel, he went back in the shack to find Lily still cowering, terrified, in the corner.
Get up from there. We need to look in them other houses to see if there's anything worth taking.
Boot went directly to Henry Dodge's cabin while pointing Lily toward the footbridge to search the other two. Boot conducted a none-too-gentle search of Henry's house, throwing useless articles on the floor and upturning tables and chairs. Interested only in guns and ammunition, he came outside again with nothing much to show for his efforts. Glancing up, he encountered Lily coming back across the creek. She cradled a rifle in her arms. Boot stopped to watch her, his hand casually resting on the handle of his revolver. A thin smile creased his lips as he waited to see what the young Creek girl would do with a rifle in her hands. With his gaze riveted upon her, she dutifully walked up to him and handed him the rifle. He knew then that he'd succeeded in breaking her spirit. When he took the rifle from her, he reached out and grabbed a handful of her hair.
Get ready to ride. There ain't nothing to stay here for.
Approaching the MKT tracks after crossing the Grand, John pulled Cousin to a halt when he spotted two figures on foot approaching from the opposite direction. Two Buck pulled up beside John.
Women.
John nodded, then urged Cousin forward to intercept the two women. Upon sighting the two men on horseback veering toward them, Rena Big Dog and Sally Redbeads turned at once and ran for safety, even though it was obviously futile. The horses overtook him in a matter of minutes. Puzzled to find the two Cherokee women alone and afoot in the middle of the prairie, Two Buck questioned them. They were reluctant to speak at first, both women eyeing Two Buck's white companion suspiciously.
John Ward?
Rena Big Dog had never before seen the white lawman, but she'd heard plenty about the big, broad-shouldered man who rode a buckskin horse. The name John Ward was known by every outlaw in the nations.
You talk white man?
Rena nodded nervously. She then answered his questions, explaining how they happened to be there, and that they were on their way to Muskogee, where Sally had family. Knowing John was a marshal, she was hesitant at first to tell him that she'd been living with Billy Sorefoot, thinking he might arrest her. Two Buck explained to her that John was looking for Boot Stoner. The eyes of both women lit up at that.
Dead! Oh, dead! He killed everybody!
When?
Yesterday.
How come you're on foot?
No time to catch horses. Afraid he gonna shoot us.
If what Sally said was true, John thought, then it would mean that he was not far behind. The buzzards had not yet discovered the second banquet left for them by Boot Stoner, since the entree was inside the shack. It was a grim scene, with only flies as the early guests. The bodies had not yet begun to bloat and were still recognizable.
Billy Sorefoot.
Two Buck then pointed toward a body lying flat on its back with a table on top of it.
Henry Dodge.
About the other two, you know him?
Never seen him before.
John stood there for a few moments more, looking over the grisly leavings. Then, with a slight nod that signaled he'd finished there, he turned to leave the shack.
Well, I guess it don't matter who they are. I doubt anybody's gonna miss them anyway.
It sure ain't hard to follow his trail. We gonna bury him?
Not hardly. Cremate him.
Do what?
Burn the shack.
Oh.
While Two Buck set fire to Billy Sorefoot's house, John scouted the clearing, looking for tracks that would tell him in which direction Boot had set out after his little party. It didn't take him long to spot the trail left by two horses and two mules leading northeast. Satisfied that it was the trail he looked for, he stood up and took a long look at the sun, already heavy in the western sky. He figured 1 hour of daylight at best.
Might as well make camp. But not here in this stinking place.
Seeing John Ward mounted and riding out, Two Buck threw part of a broken chair he was holding into the burning shack.
Damn!
He ran for his pony. Jumping on the horse's back, he galloped after the departing lawman.
Damn, John Ward, why didn't you say you was leaving?
Seemed obvious.
They had been riding through the hill country ever since early morning, and was now growing late in the afternoon. Boots seemed to be traveling at a leisurely pace, and John figured the outlaw might set up camp before much longer. Consequently, it made sense to him to hold back a little and catch Boot in his camp. If everything went the way he figured, and the cards fell just right, he might be heading back to Fort Smith with his prisoner in the morning. Crossing a wayward stream that curved around a long ridge, John pulled Cousin to a stop while he looked at the hoofprints on either side of the stream.
He stopped here and thought about making camp, judging by the prints. Decided to look for a better place.
John nodded toward the tracks leading farther along the stream.
I reckon we'd best take it a little slower from here on. We'll leave the horses here and crawl up to the top of this ridge. Maybe we can see what's ahead before we ride into it.
After tying the horses in the brush, they made their way up the slope to the rim of the ridge, where they lay flat on their bellies and scanned the valley around. For a few moments, there was nothing.
There.
Two Buck pointed to a long clump of bushes between the cottonwood trees. John stared at the spot for a brief second before seeing a thin wisp of smoke rising beyond the leafy vines.
We'll wait till dark. Give him a chance to crawl in his blanket.
After studying the lay of the land, John decided it best to split up as soon as the little stream was cloaked in darkness. Pointing to a shallow ravine that appeared to run down to the stream from the east, he instructed Two-Buck to approach the camp from that side.
When you get to the head of that ravine, I'll move in from along the stream. If we do this thing right, we ought to be able to catch him before he even knows we're here. Keep your wits about you. Don't be surprised if the girl ain't with him.
Two-Buck nodded vigorously, impatient to go.
And don't go charging in there before I work my way down to that stream. All right?
All right.
Let's go, then.
Once John reached the bank of the stream, he looked across the expanse of scrub bushes to locate Two-Buck. After a few moments, he was able to make out the Indian's form in the deepening darkness. Waving his rifle slowly back and forth over his head, he waited until Two-Buck acknowledged. Then he started working his way along the stream bank toward the fire's glow, now evident through the screen of bushes and vines. After moving approximately 20 yards closer to the camp, he came to a clearing. Dropping at once to one knee to look the situation over, he at first saw no sign of anyone near the fire. Scanning across the clearing, he saw two horses and two mules still standing with saddles and packs on. It didn't surprise him, knowing the nature of the man he was tracking. Still, there was no sign of anyone about. Instinctively, he quickly turned to look behind him, thinking that maybe Boot had somehow sensed danger. However, he could see no one. Turning back again to watch the camp, his eye caught some movement just beyond the circle of firelight. He concentrated his gaze upon it. After a few moments, he realized that what he was staring at was a prone figure seeming to bob about in the darkness. It struck him then exactly what he was witnessing. From the opposite side of the camp, the stark realization struck Two-Buck at almost the same instant. The fire provided just enough light to give him a glimpse of the young girl's face.
Lily!
Two-Buck charged into the clearing. Although totally absorbed in the fulfillment of his animal lust a brief instant before, Boot Stoner's reactions were lightning-like. His pistol always handy, he rolled off the girl, grabbing the weapon as he did. Two-Buck was an easy target.
Oh!
Two-Buck!
Damn it!
Raising his rifle, John tried to get a clear shot, but he only got a brief glimpse of the half-breed's body as Boot scrambled into the brush. Boot ran for his horses. John raised his rifle again to take aim, but Stoner was pulling the girl along behind him, shielding himself from John's rifle. Scrambling to his feet, John ran to cut the fleeing outlaw off, hoping to get a clear shot when Boot was on horseback. To further frustrate the lawman, however, Boot pulled Lily up behind him on his horse, and grabbing the reins of Lily's horse, he bounded out of the clearing at a gallop, the mules following behind on the lead rope. Cutting across the clearing, John was in a position to fire.
God damn it.
But with Lily behind Boot, he couldn't take the chance. He was left with no choice but to let the outlaw go.
Well, I won't likely get another chance like that. He knows I'm after him now.
There was little John could do about it at this point. Thoughts of pursuit first filled his mind, but he discarded them, knowing that he must first check on Tubuck. Turning to look back at the camp, he could see the body lying right where it had fallen, just short of the fire.
I'll have to take time to bury Tubuck.
He could well have been irritated with the brash young man for his premature blunder, but a genuine feeling of sorrow prevented it. In the short time he had ridden with Tubuck, he had come to like the boy. Bending over the body, John started to take Tubuck's hands to pull him up.
I'm messed up. I'm sorry, John Ward.
Taken totally by surprise, John let him sink slowly back to rest on the ground again.
Damn. I thought you were dead.
I think I'm dying. Can't feel nothing in my chest.
No, you ain't. Now lay still while I make sure Boot ain't circling back on us.
Leaving Tubuck where he lay, John jumped across the stream and ran up to the top of a low rise just beyond. Boot was already out of sight. Figuring that Boot wasn't sure how many he was up against, John was pretty sure the half-breed was likely to keep moving, and as fast as he could. Disappointed, but far from discouraged, the deputy marshal turned and went back to the camp to see if he could do anything for Tubuck.
Tubuck, I'm gonna be needing your help.
John unbuttoned Tubuck's shirt and pulled it open to reveal two dark bullet holes.
Both slugs are still in you. Nothing came all the way through. Guess you were lucky he got you with a pistol instead of a rifle. Like I said, you ain't dead, but I need to get you to a doctor, or I'm afraid you will be. At least you ain't spitting up blood, so I reckon he missed your lung. You lie still. I'll get the horses. I've got some cloth in my saddlebags we can use to stuff those bullet holes to stop the bleeding.
With Tubuck unable to sit a saddle, John set about fashioning a travois to carry him to a doctor. If they were closer to Fort Gibson, that would have been his choice of doctors, but he was afraid Tubuck might not make it that far before bleeding out. There was an alternative, albeit one that some might think risky. Dr. Walter Summerlin had established a small clinic with the help of his daughter Lucinda in the Cherokee settlement of Red Bow. There was some question concerning the reasons for the elderly physician's presence in a remote settlement in Indian Territory. Some said it was his Christian compassion for the plight of the red man. Others, whom John Ward figured were closer to the truth, were certain Dr. Summerlin had left a practice back east in shame, mortified by the unnecessary death of a patient during a drunken attempt at surgery. It was rumored the inebriated surgeon's hand was so unsteady that he accidentally severed an artery, causing the patient to bleed out on the table. John knew the doctor. He'd stopped to visit him and his daughter on more than one occasion when his business caused him to be in the vicinity of the Indian village on the East Fork of the Verdigris. The doctor had a fondness for alcohol, but in his waning years, the drink had become a demon in his system. He no longer had the tolerance for whiskey that he enjoyed in his younger years. Consequently, there were now scant degrees of intoxication. One drink and he was steady as a rock, two or more and he was a useless drunk. John Ward did not set himself up to judge the doctor's weaknesses. He knew Summerlin to be a good man, morally. Sober, he was a competent surgeon. One drink and he was even better. It mattered little in Tubuck's case, however, for John was convinced that it was either Dr. Summerlin or die on the trip back to Fort Gibson for the young Cherokee. As soon as daylight permitted, he would settle Tubuck on the travois and head west for Red Bow. Some 4 miles north, still pushing his horse hard across the darkened prairie, Boot Stoner finally decided there was no one following him. He reined back and dismounted to let the exhausted animals rest. They had had only one brief stop when Boot halted long enough to put Lily on her own horse. Now he waited for the girl to catch up to him.
What was that you yelled out back there when them bastards jumped us? I heard you yell something like you knew them.
Tubuck. It was Tubuck you killed.
Tubuck? Who the hell's Tubuck?
He worked for my father while you were in prison.
You mean my father? Wendell Stoner weren't your daddy. You ain't no kin of mine. How about the other fella? The one that took a shot at us? Did you get a look at him?
It was John Ward.
John Ward? John Ward.
Then it came to him. He was a deputy marshal. Boot had talked to a couple of fellow inmates at Little Rock who were there courtesy of John Ward. They had both said that once John Ward was on your trail, you might as well throw up your hands and surrender, because he was harder to shake than the devil.
Damn lawmen. I heard of him. I bet there was only the two of them. I gotta go back there and shoot his ass. But I reckon it's his luck I ain't got the time right now. I want to pay a little visit to that store in Oswego to see if Billy and Henry were really onto something worth looking into.
There was one additional reason to keep riding to Oswego. It was in Kansas territory and out of John Ward's jurisdiction.
John Ward will come after you.
Is that right? Well, it'll be hell for him to pay if he does.
Lucinda Summerlin stepped off the short back stoop of her father's modest frame house, carrying a basin of bloody water. Waiting until she was well away from the house, she scattered the contents of the basin across the bare ground and stood idly watching the dusty soil soak up the water. The boy she had just stitched up had been brought to see her father after he fell from a horse and landed upon his hunting knife. The wound was not as serious as it first appeared, but it did require 4 stitches. Lucinda, or Lucy, as her father called her, was very adept at minor first aid, having helped her father since she was a young girl. That was quite a few years back, more than she liked to think about. Sometimes she would permit herself to wonder what her life might have been had her mother not died when Lucy was only 13. It was a long, painful illness that reduced her mother to little more than a skeleton before she was finally taken by God. The loss of his beloved wife was more than Walter Summerlin could reconcile. Devastated by what he perceived as an uncalled-for cruelty to one so innocent, his desperate recourse was to turn to the bottle in an attempt to drown his grief. After an extended absence, he finally resolved to deal with the loss of his wife and returned to his practice. Unfortunately for him, however, alcohol had taken a firm grip upon him, and he found it impossible to function without it. Her father's battle with grief and alcohol was a heart-rending experience as seen through the eyes of a 13-year-old. As much as she grieved her mother's passing, she felt more compassion for her father. She had felt it was her responsibility to take care of him, so she stood by him in his darkest moments, forsaking a life of her own in order to help him carry on. Still, she found herself wondering how different her life might have been if she and her father had been able to remain in the East.
Little use in spending wasteful thoughts on what might have been.
She turned to go back to the house. When she turned, her gaze fell upon a rose bush she had planted near the kitchen door.
Maybe I should have dumped the basin on my roses. The blood might have nourished the soil.
Lucy started toward the door. But paused again when something across the valley caught her eye. Shielding her eyes with her hand, she stared toward the hills on the far side, making out 2 horses. As they got a little closer, she could see that there was 1 rider, while the 2nd horse was pulling a travois. It was not an uncommon sight. Many of their Indian patients were transported to her father's clinic by travois.
I'd best go tell Father that another patient is coming.
She hesitated a few moments longer. There was a familiar look about the rider on the lead horse, and she continued to stare hard in an effort to get a better picture. It didn't appear to be an Indian. A few moments more, and she suddenly felt a tiny flutter in her heart.
John Ward.
Although still over 100 yards away, there was no mistaking the solid, wide-shouldered form of the deputy marshal. With no further hesitation, she immediately turned on her heel.
Dad! Someone's coming!
Who is it?
Looks like John Ward. He's hauling somebody on a travois.
Dr. Summerlin quickly went out to meet the arriving man.
Howdy, Doc.
Well, John, looks like you've run down another outlaw.
Not this time. This is a friend. Got shot up pretty bad last night. There's 2 slugs still in him. Name's Two Buck.
John dismounted while Dr. Summerlin stepped off the porch and walked around to the travois. While the deputy stood silently by, the doctor examined the 2 bullet wounds in Tubuck's chest.
He's a good man, Doc. I'd be obliged if you could patch him up.
Hello, John.
Miss Summerlin?
Miss Summerlin. I swear, John, you can call me Lucy, for goodness sakes.
Yes, ma'am. Lucy.
After a brief examination, Summerlin stood up straight.
Well, young fella, I guess if you're still alive after bouncing across the hills on that travois, then you've got a pretty good chance of making it. Let's carry you inside.
Eyes wide open, but saying not a word, Two-Buck lay still while John and Dr. Summerlin lifted him up from the travois. With John at his shoulders and the doctor at his feet, the injured man was carried toward the porch. Lucy held the door for them.
I'm gonna need your help, honey. Let's get him on the table, get that shirt off of him. Better pump some water into that basin so we can clean him up a little. John, you can wait in the kitchen if you want to. Make yourself at home. There's some coffee on the stove. It's probably still got some cake to it.
Much obliged.
Once Two-Buck was settled upon the table, John turned to make a hasty retreat to the kitchen. Going through the doorway, he glanced back once more, only to meet Lucy's gaze again. He looked quickly away, still afraid she might think him too bold. In the kitchen, he found the coffee pot sitting on the edge of the stove, just as the doctor had said. Looking around in the cupboard, he found a cup and filled it with the black liquid. Thoughts of Lucinda Summerlin caused him to reflect upon the strange effect the woman had upon him. Lucy was a fine-looking woman, tall and strong. No nonsense about her, either. She was not what he would call a beautiful woman. How many women were who lived in this wild country? But he would bet she had been a handsome young girl in her day.
Hell, she still cuts a fine figure.
He thought about that for a second before admonishing himself for wondering about things that were none of his business. It occurred to him that he never considered himself a lonely man until he was in her presence. It was over an hour before the door to Dr. Summerlin's surgery opened and the doctor came out. Going straight to a lower cupboard, he took out a bottle and a glass and poured a drink. He downed it before bringing the bottle to the table.
I'm too damned old to do this work anymore. I swear, whiskey is the only thing that keeps me going.
What about Two-Buck? Is he gonna make it?
Who? Oh, the Indian. Yes, he'll live. You can take him out and get him shot up again. But not for a couple of weeks.
Lucy came out of the room then, carrying another basin full of bloody water. She paused when she saw John sitting there drinking coffee.
Oh, are you drinking that awful stuff? It's been on the stove since before sunup.
I made some fresh. I hope you don't mind.
Oh, in that case, I'll have some too, as soon as I get rid of this. Your friend is resting easy right now, but he won't be ready to ride for a week or so.
Much obliged.
As much as John had come to like the young Cherokee, and even though Two-Buck was desperate to rescue Lily, John still had no intention of letting Boot Stoner's trail grow cold. When Lucy returned, she poured herself a cup of coffee and sat down opposite John.
Well, John Ward, I have to say you make passable coffee. When the doctor makes coffee, he uses more beans than water.
Is there some place around here where Two-Buck could lay up for a while till he gets his strength back?
He can stay in the spare room till he gets on his feet. I thought you might be staying with him. We thought we might have some company for a few days.
I wish I could, but I was chasing a murdering half-breed when Two-Buck got himself shot. I need to get back on his trail just as quick as I can. I'm afraid he might have already given me the slip. I'm much obliged to you for taking care of Two-Buck. I'll see you get paid for the doctor and his keep.
Well, there's no use starting out this late in the day. You might as well stay for supper. It's probably been a while since you've had a decent meal. I don't suppose you've gotten yourself married since we saw you last.
No, ma'am. I doubt if anybody'd have me. I thank you for the invitation, but I really ought to get started back. I reckon I'll look in on Two-Buck for a minute and then I'll be off.
You'll be missing a good supper. Lucy's a damn good cook.
Yes, sir. I know she is. But I don't want to put you good folks out any more than I already have.
Well, suit yourself.
After looking in on his wounded friend, John unsaddled Two-Buck's horse and turned it in with the doctor's horses. He was checking Cousin's girth strap in preparation to leave when Lucy came out of the kitchen with half a cake of cornbread wrapped in a dish towel.
Here, this is left over from earlier. There's no telling when you'll stop to eat.
Well, thank you, ma'am.
John turned and put it away in his saddlebag. When he turned back to face Lucy, it was to find her gazing intently into his face. It was an expectant gaze, and he sensed that he was called to respond somehow, but he was dumbfounded as to the nature of that response.
I swear, John Wart, sometimes I wonder if there's anything going on inside that head of yours. Take care of yourself.
She took no more than 3 steps before spinning on her heel. Stalking back up to him, she reached up and planted a kiss on his lips.
What?
Then, without another word, she turned and marched to the kitchen, leaving him mystified and mesmerized. He watched her until she disappeared into the house and the door had closed behind her. His mind revolving in a whirlpool of bewilderment, he could still feel the burn of her lips upon his. He had a feeling that the sensation would dwell in his mind for a long time, giving him something to puzzle over till he could sort out the confusion it generated. He found it hard to believe that a fine-looking woman like Lucinda Summerlin could possibly have any affection for a weather-beaten range rider like himself. Inside the house, Dr. Summerlin smiled at his daughter.
I saw that little farewell through the window.
You did? I guess he's still trying to figure out what happened. He's so damn smart in some ways and so dumb in others. Hell, Pop, I'm not getting any younger. Ugh. I expect I'd better throw some supper together. You'd best get some food in your stomach to mix with the whiskey you've already downed today. I'll look in on John Ward's Indian friend after supper.
Lily waded out into the river up to her knees, her legs numb in the chilly water, her skirt tied up around her waist. She slowly lowered her bottom into the water, being careful not to let her skirt fall. Some 30 yards behind her on the shore, Boot Stoner sat by the fire, rolling himself a smoke. He would be satisfied for the night now, permitting her to sleep unmolested. Her mind long since adapted to the half-breed's use of her body, she no longer tried to resist his assault. It had become almost mundane as she lay waiting for him to reach his satisfaction. She had learned early on that to protest and resist only brought physical pain to accompany the ordeal. At this point in the shallow river, she was almost a third of the distance across. With Boot lounging by the fire, she could easily push out into the deeper water and swim to the other side. She would be gone before he even took notice of her absence. There was no thought of escape, however. She had resigned herself to the fact that she was simply now Boot's property, like his horse or his rifle. What good would a few hours of freedom do anyway? He would only come after her, and the punishment would be far worse than before. Even if she did manage to evade him, where would she go? The only place she had relatives was Lohawk, and that was a long way away from this river on the Kansas border.
Hey, get your lazy ass out of that water. I'm hungry.
She responded to his command immediately, wading ashore and hurrying up to the fire. Standing before the fire, she rubbed her legs vigorously with her skirt in an effort to dry them, all the while being careful not to expose too much of her legs so as not to arouse his interest again. She need not have worried. Boot's mind was on another passion. In a talkative mood, he proceeded to voice his intentions while she prepared his meal.
Billy was right. Oswego can't be far from here. We ought to make it before noon tomorrow. Of course, Billy Sorefoot and Henry Dodge was born liars, but if what they said was true, that store in Oswego might be easy pickings.
No more flour.
We'll stock up tomorrow.
His mind skipped back to another subject then, one that concerned him, even though he would not admit it.
What do you know about this lawman that took a shot at me the other night?
John Ward? He stopped at my father's house several times.
My father's house? Wendell Stoner weren't your daddy. Now this John Ward, what's he supposed to be? Some big dog lawman or something?
I don't know. They say he'll never stop until he gets his man.
I'm damn sure not afraid of John Ward or any other two-bit lawman. Hope to hell he does keep coming. He won't follow us in Kansas anyway.
Doug Fannin gazed fondly at the carved nameplate that resided on the right-hand corner of his desk. James Douglas Fannin, it proclaimed. Given to him by his wife Joyce when he finished law school, it had never graced the desk of a practicing lawyer. Instead, Doug, as his friends called him, decided his fortune lay in the field of trade and the new frontier. In the summer of 1865, he journeyed west until he reached the little settlement of Oswego in Kansas Territory. Seeing potential for the little town nestled in a crook of the Neosho River, he decided to plant his roots right there. Due to his shrewd business sense and a fair-dealing attitude, the trading post he established soon became a thriving store that did business with settlers and Indians alike.
Doug? There's a man outside that wants to talk trade with you.
Upon first glance at the customer awaiting him outside, Fannin felt an internal warning of caution. The man was a lean, raw-boned individual, dark of complexion. Fannin guessed a half-breed, wearing a smirk of contempt. There was a young woman with him. A girl, really, he decided on second glance. Riding two horses, they had two mules on a lead rope, packed with an odd lot of household items. Fannin walked past his wife.
Honey, go in the back room and tell Ed to come out here. Good afternoon to you, friend. What can I do for you?
I got some things I'm looking to trade.
Looks like you brought a whole household on those mules.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it?
What are you looking to trade for?
I don't know. A gun, some ammunition, some whiskey maybe.
I don't sell whiskey or guns either, but I do carry some cartridges and shotgun shells.
Is that so? Well, I'll just go inside and see what you got. You can take a look through them packs to see if there's anything you want to swap for.
Fannin glanced up at Lily, who was still seated on her horse. He was about to ask if she'd like to dismount when Ed appeared in the doorway.
You sent for me, Mr. Fannin?
Yes, Ed. Go on back inside and help this gentleman.
Ed Swadley was not endowed with an especially active brain, and Fannin didn't expect him to help a customer with anything, since he was barely able to help himself. Fannin had given the simple man a job, another of his charitable acts. The job primarily consisted of cleaning the store and the outhouse. He had, in fact, sent for Ed simply because he didn't want Joyce to be alone in the store with a man who looked capable of violence.
Help him do what?
Nothing. Just go on back in the store while I look through these packs.
Confused, Swadley shrugged. Just then, Boot turned to go inside, coming face to face with Fannin's bumbling employee. Both men were equally surprised.
Well, I'll be danged. Boot Stoner.
Shut your mouth. Do like he told you.
Boot looked back to see if Fannin had heard the exchange, but the storekeeper was already on the other side of one of the mules, giving no indication that he had.
When did you get out?
Boot looked quickly around to make sure no one else was in earshot. The store was empty except for the two of them, Joyce Fannin having gone into the office.
What the hell are you doing here?
Ed Swadley was perhaps the last person he'd ever expected to encounter, especially in a settlement like Oswego. A petty thief and pickpocket, Swadley was known to him in prison, but not a man Boot would associate with even there.
Oh, I work here. Mr. Fannin gave me a job.
Is that so?
Boot was on the verge of threatening him to keep his mouth shut when it occurred to him that he might make use of the simple-minded man.
So, you work here, do you? What does he pay you?
50 cents a day.
50 cents a day. How'd you like to go partners with me and make you some real money?
You mean I could ride with you?
Yeah, you can ride with me. All you gotta do is make sure that back door ain't locked when it closes up tonight. You can do that, can't you?
Oh, I don't know, Boot. He don't let me lock up. He puts a padlock on both doors and carries the key on him.
What about the windows?
Oh, he locks them and latches the shutters.
Well, goddammit, you ought to be able to sneak around behind him and unlock a window.
Oh, yeah, Boot. I bet I could do that.
One of them in the back, away from the street.
Ed looked puzzled, but Boot didn't have time to explain before Fannin walked in.
Don't let on you know me.
Boot received a large, exaggerated wink of the eye in reply.
Ed, you can go on back to cleaning up the storeroom now. Mister, I didn't see a whole lot of things I could sell on your packs. Some pots and pans and some blankets and tools was about all I could use.
Well, that's all right. I didn't see nothing in here I wanted anyway.
Well, wasn't he the odd one?
Ed was still standing in the room.
I'm just as glad he decided to leave. He had a mean look about him. He didn't have anything of value that I could see anyhow. Nothing but well-worn household goods.
He walked to the door then to take another look as Boot and Lily slow-walked their horses down the dusty street.
Ed, there's some strange folks who pass through here.
Yes, sir. I'll get to that storeroom now.
It was well past dark when Boot guided his horse up to the back of Douglas Fannin's store, with Lily following close behind. He had no sooner dismounted than a figure emerged from the shadows by the corner of the stockroom.
It's me, Ed Swadley.
Boot's pistol was trained on him in a flash. Like a faithful dog, the simple-minded thief had been waiting for Boot's return.
Well, you almost got your ass blown away. Which one of them windows did you fix?
Oh, well, see, that's just it, Boot. I didn't get to unlatch any of them. I was going to, but Mr. Fannin, he run me out before he locked up.
Well, you dumb... Hell, then. What good are you to me?
Disgusted, he pushed past the bewildered simpleton. Walking up to the back door, he tried it several times, even though the padlock was plainly visible.
Lily, there's a chopping axe packed on one of the mules. You go fetch it. Well, I take a look to see if there's anybody around.
Boot moved up the side of the store, keeping in the shadows, until he reached the front of the building. There was a saloon about 75 yards up the street. Other than that, the town was quiet. When he returned, walking back along the opposite side of the building, Lily was waiting with the axe. Boot grabbed it and shoved it into Ed's hands.
Chop me a hole through that door.
Mr. Fannin ain't gonna like this.
What do you care? You're riding with me now.
Oh, yes, sir. I sure am. There she is.
Boot entered the darkened storeroom. Before he got far, he had to strike a match to see his way to the door that connected the room to the store.
Another goddamn locked door. But at least the hinges are on this side. Find me something to knock these hinge pins out with.
Best keep to this side with that there match.
Boot was about to ask why when he turned to hold the lit match toward the other side of the small room and discovered several cases of dynamite stacked against the wall.
Jesus!
He drew the match back so quickly it almost went out.
Why didn't you tell me there was dynamite in here? Get that damn door off the hinges.
Ed found a screwdriver and took the hinges out of the door in a matter of moments. Once inside the store proper, Boot wasted little time in ransacking the shelves for anything that appealed to him. Hesitant about lighting a lamp, the three of them groped around the shelves, the two men gathering up ammunition, knives, and tobacco, Lily collecting what foodstuff she could find.
Yeah, that's all I can pack on them mules. Where does he keep the money?
There's a drawer under the counter.
Boot picked up a crowbar from a shelf of various tools and made short work of the lock. Opening the drawer, he was disappointed to find no more than $55 in currency.
Damn it. Is this all there is? I know that son of a bitch has got more money than this.
Well, most of the time he takes it home and puts it in the safe.
Well, maybe we ought to go and pay him a visit. Lily, finish up them packs.
Boot stepped to the front window and peered through the shutters. The voices he had heard came from the last stragglers from the saloon down the road. He stood watching while a couple of men made their way unsteadily along the middle of the street. They were opposite the front door of the store when Ed Swadley dropped a large glass container of peppermint sticks.
Uh-oh!
The drunks paused and stared at the store for a few moments before exchanging words that Boot couldn't make out, but could well guess. They promptly turned around and scurried off down the road again.
Damn you, Swadley! You've given us away! Get in a saddle, Lily.
I'll get my horse.
You ain't gonna need no horse. You dumb turd. You cost me money.
Boot hurried to join Lily out back, but when passing through the storeroom, he saw one last way to take out his anger against Fannin. Acting quickly, he hazarded another match to see. Busting the lid of a crate, he took out a stick of dynamite. Hurrying back inside, he placed the dynamite in Swadley's hand.
Here's your share of the goods, partner.
Boot made a hasty retreat, pausing only to pick up a couple more sticks of dynamite.
These might come in handy.
Outside, he ran for his horse.
Ride.